So good evening, everyone. My name is Lisa Richman, and I'm a volunteer with the Holocaust Education Committee. And on behalf of the Sarah and Chaim Neuberger Holocaust Education Center and UJA Federation of Greater Toronto, I want to welcome everyone to this program this evening. So first, I'd like to thank our host venue, Shaar Shamayim, for giving us the space. And I also want to give a special thank you to the Melamed and Hart families who have generously co-sponsored this program this evening in memory of Colin Melamed. So Holocaust Education Week is especially grateful to our presenting sponsor, Great Gulf, and to our lead sponsors, the Apotex Foundation, the Israeli Foundation, and the Elizabeth and Tony Comper Foundation. We're also really proud to have CTV News and the National Post as our media sponsors. This year is the 34th year for Holocaust Education Week, and our theme this year is collaboration. All of the programs will explore distinct ways in which individuals and groups participated in and responded to the persecution and genocide by the Nazi regime. So if anyone needs a program, I have some programs placed on the table where the coffee machine is. And you should also, I encourage you to look at the website, which is one word, holocausteducationweek.com, to check for any updates or changes in the schedule. And finally, Holocaust Education Week, we need your support. Generous donations will allow us to continue our programs in future years and to bring outstanding educational programs to students and to the communities. So on the table, there are also donation cards, so please fill them out. And you can also donate on our website as well. And finally, just as a reminder for people to turn off their electronic devices or switch them on to silent. And if you're going to use them, what we are encouraging people to do this year is to use Twitter or Facebook or emails just to send messages to people, tell them that you're at programs, and encourage your friends and family to join us at other programs in the next couple of weeks. And the shul had asked me to mention that door is closed off. You can't have any access to the main area because of construction. And if anyone needs washrooms, they're in the lower level in the youth wing. So I'll pass the mic on to you guys.
Good evening. I'm Dr. Elliot Malamut, and I also would like to thank the host venue, Shaar Shamayim, on behalf of Torah in Motion, and of course on behalf of my mother, my sister and brother, and all of their families. This is the fifth annual event in memory of my father, Colin, who passed away in 2007. My dad was born in Dresden, and like all German Jews, my father and his family had life and death decisions to make in the 1930s. My father's family decided to send him away alone as a young teenager when Hitler came to power. He ended up first in London and then in Palestine, where he met my mother. May she live and be well. My father's father was not so lucky. He was arrested by the Nazis, thrown in jail, and killed. So like all European Jews of that era, my father carried the weight of childhood separation and tragedy with him, but he carried on. He built a new life, a new home, and a family. I think he would have been deeply interested in tonight's discussion, and may his memory be for a blessing. This past August, writing in The Guardian in London, John Henley reported on the current state of affairs in Europe. In the space of 1 week in July, 8 synagogues in France were attacked. The crowd's chants included death to Jews and slit Jews' throats. And in Germany, Molotov cocktails were lobbied in the Bergische Synagogue in Wuppertal, previously destroyed, and Kristallnacht. Chants at pro-Palestinian protests compared Israel's actions to the Holocaust, and other slogans included Jew, coward, pig, come out and fight alone, or Hamas, Hamas, Jews to the gas. An Amsterdam rabbi had his front door stoned. Two Jewish women were attacked, one beaten, one a victim of arson, after they hung Israeli flags from their balconies. A Swedish Jew was beaten with iron pipes. In Belgium, 4 people were fatally shot in May at the Jewish Museum in Brussels. And although the violent stories received a lot of press coverage, there are smaller and rather telling incidents as well. In Italy, Jewish owners of dozens of shops and businesses in Rome arrived to find swastikas and anti-Jewish slogans on shutters and windows. One slogan read, "Jews, your end is near." And here are three from Belgium. In Brussels, a woman was turned away from a shop with the words, "We don't currently sell to Jews." In Liège, a Turkish shop owner posted a sign saying he would serve dogs, but not Jews. And on the commuter run from Namur to Brussels, racists aborted the crowded train, snatched control of the PA system, and said the following, "Ladies and gentlemen, we are approaching Auschwitz. All Jews are requested to disembark and take a short shower," unquote. The result of all this, a recent report issued jointly by two European Jewish organizations, found that 40% of European Jews hide their Jewishness. Police and Jewish organizations have, of course, long observed a spike in anti-Semitic incidents each time the Israeli-Palestinian conflict flares up. But according to many Jewish leaders, this time it is different. More than simply a reaction to the conflict, they say that the threats, the hate speech, and the violent attacks feel like the expression of a much deeper and more widespread anti-Semitism. "These are the worst times since the Nazi era," said the president of Germany's Council of Jews. "On the streets you hear things like, the Jews should be gassed, the Jews should be burned. We haven't had that in Germany for decades." And as Roger Kuckerman, president of France's CRIF, which is the representative council of Jewish organizations in France, noted, "They're not screaming death to the Israelis on the streets of Paris. They're screaming death to Jews." So when I contacted Daniel Goldhagen almost 9 months ago in February to ask him if he'd like to have a public conversation about European anti-Semitism, I didn't imagine that a few months later there would be a war in Gaza and that anti-Semites would be in the streets of New York and Paris and Barcelona and Oakland and Cape Town and London and Sydney, just to name a few. Or, for that matter, that my family and I would be repeatedly retreating into our safe room in Jerusalem, or getting out of a car and crouching at the side of the road in response to Hamas rocket fire. But in this case, life unfortunately preceded and eerily echoed our topic. So I'm certainly delighted that Professor Goldhagen is here now and that we can talk in light of all these events. Daniel Goldhagen is the author of Hitler's Willing Executioners, Ordinary Germans and the Holocaust, which has been published in 15 languages and hailed as a landmark by the New York Times. He's also the author of A Moral Reckoning, The Role of the Catholic Church in the Holocaust, as well as The Devil Never Dies, The Rise and Threat of Global Antisemitism. Dr. Goldhagen received his doctorate from Harvard, where he was a professor of history. His work has also appeared in major American and European journals and newspapers, and he's been interviewed on many, many major media outlets. Please welcome Professor Daniel Goldhagen. Let's begin with Europe right now. It seems that for many years after the Shoah, Europeans were understandably reticent about expressing anti-Semitic feelings, much less acting upon them. But those post-Holocaust inhibitions have apparently dissipated, and hating Jews is once more a legitimate public subject. I'm interested in the timing. Why now? Has some secret code been unleashed that it's okay now to be publicly anti-Semitic again? And I'm being a bit facetious, but the thesis that it's just anti-Zionism gone viral has been challenged by Jews who are on the front lines in Europe. So what do you see as the factors that have led to this change?
Well, Elliot, first, thank you for inviting me, and I'm delighted to be here with you, of course, though not so delighted to be talking about what we're talking about tonight. With your first question, you've posed enough questions that we could spend the rest of the evening just with one answer. So let me just say a few things about it. In speaking about European anti-Semitism, you have to tell a complex story since the post-war period or since the end of the Holocaust. You have to say that it has declined enormously, and it has been de-demonized in the sense that there are few Europeans who look upon Jews, human beings that happen to be Jewish, and see devils in human form, which was the norm in Germany during the mid part of the 20th century and was quite common elsewhere in Europe as well. We know a great deal about anti-Semitism, particularly in Germany, and it has declined enormously, and it has been de-demonized at its core. That's the good news. The bad news is, even though it's declined enormously, there's still a lot of it left. And it's becoming, and anti-Semitism is becoming re-demonized, which is a new demonology which is being attributed to Jews, centered around Israel and the United States, and we'll talk more about it. And so, the secular trend has been an improvement, downward, and I don't know which way the slope goes for you, but a downward slope. But in the last 10 or 15 or 20 years, there's been a resurgence up to levels that hadn't been seen for a while. Now, there are two ways to think about or to measure anti-Semitism or to note it. One is by finding out what people believe about Jews, what their emotions are towards Jews, what their orientation is towards Jews. And you can do that by survey research plus a lot of other kinds of investigative work. And then there is then the question becomes how much of it enters the public sphere and when and why, and that's the question you ultimately pose. And when you look at what survey research reveals, and we've had surveys done of Europeans quite consistently over the past decade and a half, you find that, and I'm not going to get into the interpretation of the numbers, that between 40 and 50% of Europeans are clearly, by any reasonable definition of anti-Semitism, extremely anti-Semitic. 40 to 50%. We can go over it if you want to, why those are the numbers. And which means that they have prejudicial views against Jews, they have views about Jews which lead them to think ill of Jews and to make them ready to believe new accusations about Jewish, about the malfeasance of Jews, what they do to others, what they intend to do to others, what they might do to others. What you have seen, though, in the last couple of decades is an increasing appearance of this anti-Semitism in the public sphere through anti-Semitic expression. More and more of it is being expressed in the public sphere, in the media, at rallies, by politicians, and all the ways that things enter the public sphere, with the huge outbursts of such expression taking place during the recent Gaza war. Now, why exactly it has occurred is a very interesting question, and I don't think anyone can give you a definitive answer, and I can't either. I can say things about it. But what has become clear is that the taboo that existed in Europe in the post-Holocaust period, which lasted for 40 years, for about 40 years, you could live in Europe, practically anywhere in Europe, and never encounter a public anti-Semitic remark in the media, by a politician, by just about anyone speaking openly in public. It was remarkable. It was subterranean, but it was not public. And this taboo has eroded gradually since around 1990, picking up steam in 1995, picking up steam, a lot of steam with the Second Intifada, and culminating now in what is really open season on Israel and on Jews. And I'll just add one thing, and then, Elliot, you can come back and add your own thoughts to this. Anyone who says that this is because of Israel is either ignorant of, really ignorant of, or not playing, or not being honest with the facts. If you think about this period when this resurgence of public anti-Semitism has occurred, it's quite remarkable in that it began for the first 10 years during the most hopeful period of Israeli-Palestinian-Israeli-Arab relations, during the Oslo peace process, as it's been called. When people were most optimistic that the conflict could be settled, that's when anti-Semitism began to make its comeback in the public sphere. If it's about Israel, then why did it take place when, during the period when you would have thought there'd be the least public anti-Semitic expression, not the most, not a resurgence, not the beginning of a new trend?
No, the data actually backs this up, right? There was a Pew Research Center study that was conducted in Germany, and it says that although around 6% of the population is Muslim, 25% of the people readily express unfavorable views of Jews. So, in other words, it's not demographically backed up that this is just a Israeli conflict thing. In Spain, less than 3% of the population is Muslim, and 50% of the population registered unfavorable impressions of Jews. So it's clear that this is a much deeper phenomena, and we'll get back to that in a second. I want to take this back to the Shoah and move it forward so that we can sort of get historical context. In Hitler's Willing Executioners, you write that Germans' anti-Semitic beliefs about Jews were the central causal agent of the Holocaust, not, as many people have tried to argue, that it was simply related to the Nazis and the Nazi Party, but rather this was an across-the-board sort of common person belief. And the conclusion of the book is that anti-Semitism moved many thousands of ordinary Germans and would have moved millions more had they been, you know, appropriately positioned to slaughter Jews. In other words, it wasn't economic hardship. It wasn't the coercive means of a totalitarian state, not social psychological propensities, but ideas about Jews that were pervasive in Germany and had been for decades. Induced ordinary Germans to kill unarmed, defenseless Jewish men, women, and children by the thousands systematically and without pity. Could you explain why you believe that the attitude of the ordinary German or the ordinary Pole was far from innocent in the Shoah and was in fact complicit with the killing?
Before I do so, I just want to pull back for one moment. This will be brief because you reminded me of something by citing one of the explanations people typically give for why Germans or others persecuted and killed Jews. The most common explanation given for anti-Semitism, for the persecution of Jews historically, has been that an economic explanation. There are various forms of it. Jews do well economically, so people are jealous of them. Or during economic downturns, people turn to Jews as scapegoats to explain their own suffering and so on. And this is trotted out reflexively again and again. It doesn't map the historical data. There are so many reasons for thinking it's wrong, but leave that aside. When people talk about the current rise of anti-Semitism, they say they don't mention economic matters. They say it's because of Israel and Israel's politics. And you have actually here, it's quite remarkable to me that people haven't put these two things together. You have the same phenomenon, anti-Semitism. It has a different, somewhat different form today. And for the old days, everybody said, it's all economic, that's why it happened. And today they say, it's all political, that's why it happened. Both can't be true. They just simply both can't be true. It's the same phenomenon, and in fact, neither is correct. If you want to understand why ordinary Germans or the Poles who helped them slaughter Jews or collaborated in the killing of Jews or Ukrainians or Lithuanians or people in France or many others, you have to understand the long development of anti-Semitism in Europe and why it took on the ferocious forms it did and why it took on the particular and peculiarly modern form it did under the Nazis and in Germany, to understand why people would look at a Jewish man or a Jewish woman in a Jewish shawl and say, I need to kill that person, even though the person was not manifestly threatening in any way. You want to understand why Europeans today are so prone to believing the craziest things, really out of this world stuff about Israel, Israelis, and Jews. You have to understand the framework of understanding they bring towards perceiving and making sense of what Jews or Israelis or Israel do in the world. Now, with regard to ordinary Germans and ordinary Poles, Ukrainians, what have you, again, a complex argument boiled down, there's a vast amount of evidence that anti-Semitism was the public and private norm in Germany. Let me just stick to Germany for a moment. In Germany, long before Hitler came to power, all you have to do is even ask a German expert what segment of German society was free from anti-Semitism, actually looked upon what was said about Jews, that they are a race apart, that their blood is programs them to be evil, that they have caused financial collapse, that they led to the loss of the First World War and so on. What segment of the German population heard all this utter nonsense and said, this is just total nonsense? There, people in Germany didn't think they should kill Jews and so on, but what people looked upon, her, what segment of the population, even among the political and economic and social elites of Germany, thought that this was total nonsense. And the answer is, you can't find them. And there's a vast amount of evidence that ordinary Germans were anti-Semitic and that they were essentially Hitlerian anti-Semites and that they had a racist understanding of what made Jews different and what made Jews dangerous and what the character was of their perniciousness and of the threat that they posed to Germany and the harm they had done to Germany. So that's one thing. The historical work is clear. It's, if you're interested, you can read the first 100 pages of Hitler's Way Executioners. I lay it out. But then, if you look at the perpetrators of the Holocaust, the people who did the actual killing, contrary to how they had been represented, and still to this day are represented by and large, many of them were not Nazis, not in the SS. They were not members of the Nazi Party. They were not in the SS. They were ordinary people from all walks of life, all educational backgrounds, all non-Jewish Christian by and large. And they were drafted into the duty of being policemen in occupied territory, and when they were told to kill, when they received the orders, they were orders, when they're told to kill, you found that they not only carried out the orders, but carried out the orders with enormous zeal, with the attentiveness and passion and thoroughness of true believers. They did more than they had to do. They didn't drag their feet. And they did this even though many of them knew that they didn't have to kill because the commanders told them they didn't have to. In many units, commanders told their men, if you're not up to the duty, tell me, I'll give you other duties. Nothing will happen to you. When such offers were made, very few of the perpetrators avail themselves of the opportunity to get out of, in this case, shooting men, women, and children at point-blank range in scenes of unspeakable gruesomeness. And those who did ask to get out were actually given other jobs. They were not punished in any serious way. They were not punished. And so all the others knew that the offer was genuine. So why would someone who could get out of something as gruesome and as immoral, if you actually didn't think Jews deserved to be slaughtered, why would someone not avail himself of the opportunity to get out of the killing? The answer is obvious. It's because they thought it was the right thing to do, because they looked upon the Jews and saw devils in human form. And furthermore, and again, I'm just giving you a capsule summary of the reasons why, and furthermore, we know that they thought this because they have told us so. In their post-war testimony, they have told us about their anti-Semitism. This is post-war testimony in the German legal system during post-war legal investigations and trials. And I'll quote one man who was in a police battalion and speaking for all his comrades said, "The Jew was not considered by us to be a human being." That's what he said, and that's the way it was. And so when you know that ordinary Germans willfully and willingly and gladly, even if sometimes finding it a bit hard to do the gruesome work, slaughter Jews, and you know that there are ordinary Germans coming from all walks of life, you see what other ordinary Germans would have done had they been in the same situation. They weren't there, they didn't do it, so we can condemn them for it. But it's a basic inference of social science, that when you have a representative sample from a population, you can generalize to that population. And so this was the mainspring of the Holocaust, and I'll just add and call this to an end right now, that the reason the Germans found so many willing helpers around Europe is because there was so much anti-Semitism, and the degree to which they found local peoples to help them and the numbers that they found correlated with the degree and intensity of anti-Semitism in this region. Oh, I said I was going to say one more thing, but I have one more thing. Which is, what I say about the German perpetrators is true of the perpetrators of other genocides as well. In this sense, they're alike. One of the books that I've written, which Ellie did not mention, is a book called Worse Than War, which is a general study of genocide. And in fact, we did a documentary for PBS, Public Television in the United States, a two-hour documentary, which is streaming online. Just type in genocide into YouTube. It's the first thing that comes up. And which treats the nature of genocide from beginning to end, from all the major questions, at least as I see them. And in all other genocides, people think of any you know of or how people talk about them, people naturally assume the perpetrators wanted to do what they did. Who assumes otherwise about the Hutu perpetrators in Rwanda, or about the killers in Guatemala, or about the Serbs who were slaughtering Bosniaks in the former Yugoslavia? And in this sense, the perpetrators of the Holocaust were like those perpetrators who had different ideologies and different prejudices, and they worked themselves out in different ways. They, too, believed that the people that they were looking at needed to die because they were a threat, and they, and the Germans and the Poles and the Ukrainians and others did so because of a particular prejudice which we know of as anti-Semitism.
I'm interested that you talked about it with zeal and passion and enthusiasm. So I'm wondering what you think about... And it's well known, you know, Hannah Arendt wrote her article, Eichmann in Jerusalem, which first appeared in The New Yorker and then was published as a book, if I recall the sequence correctly. And, you know, she came up with that phrase, which is now in the culture, banality of evil, which I think is really the last words of, last sentence of the book. And her depiction, using Eichmann as a kind of paradigm of a kind of mindless bureaucrat, not creative. I think she calls Eichmann stupid in the book, following orders, sort of the antithesis of what you're talking about, right? Not passionate, not zealous, not even that invested. I'm assuming that, you know, you don't like this thesis, and I'm wondering why you think the thesis gained currency.
Well, first a word about Eichmann and Arendt. Arendt basically made up her account of Eichmann. We know a lot about Eichmann. There have been actually some recent books published, but there have been many others published over the years. And he was an intense anti-Semite. He even boasted he boasted many times about how he would go to his grave, or certainly, he boasted certainly one time on record that he would go to his grave laughing, knowing that he had killed 5 or 6 million Jews. This is when before he was captured by the Israelis. And so he's been studied intensively. The men around him have been studied in his office, and they were impassioned, believing anti-Semites. Arendt basically made up this account of Eichmann and created this notion of banality of evil and so on. It's just nonsense. But even if it were true about Eichmann, it's just not true of the others. He would have been somehow an outlier. Because we have the words and the actions of thousands upon thousands. You know, this whole notion, it's quite interesting how people lose their minds, and I say that figuratively, but I do so purposely in this hyperbolic way, how people lose their minds when they talk about the Holocaust. They say things that they wouldn't say about any other comparable phenomenon. I just mentioned to you that people automatically assume perpetrators of other mass slaughters hate their victims and want to kill them. I mean, that's what people assume. The only one that people say the opposite about is about the Holocaust. And why would they do that when the record is so vast about both the development, the existence of anti-Semitism in Germany and elsewhere in Europe, and also among the perpetrators? It's strange. Why would people, to go back to Arendt, talk about bureaucracy in this way? If I mention bureaucracy to you in another context, or to other people, bureaucracy stands in for what? For people who don't do jobs very well, for bunglers, for people who stand in the way, who are rule bound, who drag their feet. You want to say something's not getting done, you say, oh, there's just this bureaucratic red tape and so on and so forth. This is how people typically talk about bureaucracy. And yet when they talk about the Nazi bureaucracy, the German bureaucracy, suddenly they work like the flowchart of some organization imagines that they can get people to work like clockwork. That's simply not how bureaucracies work. And when you move from talking about things such as why a bureaucrat in Ottawa or in Washington might enforce a tax policy he doesn't like or she doesn't like, to why someone, because he's a bureaucrat, would implement orders himself, the bureaucrat, to slaughter children. It's such a leap that no one stops and thinks, wait, they must have had a view about what they were doing. This isn't just I have to do my duty. They must have a view about whether it's right to smash children's heads against the walls of buildings, which is how they often killed them, when they weren't even ordered to do so. People really lose their minds when they talk. There are many other instances of when they talk about the Holocaust, they say things that don't make sense. And all you have to do is look at German society. to show how this whole following orders bureaucratic mindset just doesn't make sense. You know something? The same people who slavishly supposedly had to follow orders, or because they were in bureaucracies, or because they were terrorized, or because they were just Germans who supposedly slavishly follow orders, were the people who, when the Nazi regime pursued policies that they didn't like, would protest against them. The regime tried to remove crucifixes from the schools in Bavaria, and there was a statewide strike against the regime under the Nazi period. Well, why was there one? Because this violated their deepest values. Remove crucifixes from our schools? There were labor protests in Germany, strikes all the time because they thought they weren't being treated well economically. How could this be in Nazi Germany? Germans, like other people, had moral views of the world, expressed them, and often protested, and the regime typically backed down when it happened. But there was one policy against which there was virtually no protest ever on any scale, and it was the most unethical policy the regime was pursuing if you didn't agree with it. The most immoral policy, and that was the slaughter of an entire people. How do you make sense of that? How can Hannah Arendt make sense of this notion of the banality of evil when all over Germany and the perpetrators themselves often refused orders that they didn't like? I open Hitler's willing executions with an account of a captain in a police battalion who had received an order that he and his men had to sign that they would not steal food from Poles. Imagine, they're slaughtering Jews by the tens of thousands, and they're told to, came down from the police command, that they had to sign an oath that they would not steal food from Poles. What kind of mental, moral world are they living in to begin with? The captain refused to sign it. And he wrote a letter of insubordination and sent it up the chain of command that said, I refuse to sign it or have my men sign it because to sign it would imply that without signing it, we would steal from Poles. And this would be... And this would besmirch us as Germans and soldiers, our honor. Think of it. Think of all of his tells. That's why I opened the book with it. He evaluated the morality of the order, found it wanting. He didn't find the killing of the Jews to be immoral. He, in this supposedly most draconian of system imaginable, where if you said a word, a peep, you would have the iron fist of the state come down upon you, didn't think twice about violating the orders, putting his violation or his refusal in writing, sending up a chain of command, and guess what? Nothing happened to him. So how do we talk about this man as a bureaucrat who doesn't understand what he's doing and just does it because that's what bureaucrats do? It's an utter fantasy. Now, the reason it became popular for two reasons, or maybe more than two reasons. I'll just mention two. One is it had the ring of surprise to it. Here the great philosopher Hannah Arendt, or social theorist, whatever you want to call her, has come forth with this notion that, and this striking phrase, the banality of evil, there was a resonance in the culture. And there are other things that came out around the same time that reinforced this. But the other thing is that there had been a whitewashing of Germans, and ordinary Germans in particular, their collaboration, if you want to call it that, their participation, their support for the persecution of the Jews and the Holocaust, and many other things too, the slave labor, using of non-Jews and Jews as slave laborers. And this was because of the Cold War. There was a systematic effort to blame the regime, to blame the terror apparatus, to focus on Hitler and Himmler and so on, and to absolve ordinary Germans because they had to be our allies. They were in the front line of the Cold War. And so then she came out with this notion that really tied it all together. And could lead everybody to understand why Germans did what they did. And then furthermore, it took away, this is the third reason, it helped people not confront the most difficult question, which is why would people willfully do such a thing? What does it say about human beings, whether anti-Semites or not, that they would do such a thing? This was a very live question after the war. It disturbs many people. It disturbs anybody who confronts the Holocaust and who doesn't have one of these pat answers such as, oh, well, anybody would do that in those circumstances. Again, nonsense. But if you believe the bureaucratic explanation, then you say, aha, you know, it's not about the evil of people. And we talked to, Ellie and I had a discussion about evil earlier. We can recapitulate it for you if you want. It's not about the evil of people. It's not about the, it doesn't make me have to question my view of the goodness of human beings. You know, people in circumstances are subjected to powerful forces, and they end up doing things they wouldn't otherwise do. And, you know, it's too bad that it happens, but it's a much less threatening way to view the world, at least morally and for many existentially. And so this was also an appeal of her position.
Yes, I'm interested in that because I'm wondering whether bureaucracy explanation, all that, is actually the cover for the fact that it's really difficult to absorb that people can be so monstrous. You know, I'm thinking, as you were talking, I was thinking of this book that I read a few years ago, you probably read, by Ron Rosenbaum, explaining Hitler, right? So the book is basically talking about this Rorschach that everybody who tries to explain Hitler ends up basically reflecting on their own ideologies in this great black box because nobody can explain him. And in some ways, you read it and you think, okay, nobody can explain him, but you're sort of circumventing the point, which is that this is a really evil guy. I mean, you know, you don't, it doesn't, sometimes you feel like people in sixth grade can get things clearer than, you know. So I'm wondering if, like, all of this circumvention is because people just don't like the idea of calling something that dark, that black, and it's too scary.
You know, we are in the realm of a fair amount of speculation because we don't really have studies of why people have the wrong beliefs about the Holocaust or what have you. Ron Rosenbaum, what you mentioned about him ties in back to something I mentioned a moment ago, that we can't explain Hitler, whatever that explaining a person means. It's another thing people say about the Holocaust that they don't say about other things. People don't say we can't explain why the Second World War happened. We may find it hard to come up with a good explanation, but the Holocaust, like other genocides, like other instances of mass violence, like wars, and like many things that are complex and disturbing to us or not disturbing to us, of course they can be explained. I've given you an explanation or part of an explanation for why the perpetrators killed. We give an explanation to why the Rwandan perpetrators killed and why there was a genocide in Rwanda. No one says we can't, not no one, but people don't say we can't explain why the Crusades happened or why Rwanda happened or why the former Yugoslavia did, but they say we can't explain the Holocaust. Well, of course we can. We may find it a complex thing to do, and it may be hard to know in the end perfectly why this or that happened, but in principle it is as explainable as everything else that we, every other certainly analogous or large-scale event or set of events that we want to explain. And look, the issue of why people, the Holocaust is a very interesting symbolic and cultural phenomenon in the world today and since the Second World War, because everybody, the proverbial everybody, or at least in countries that concern themselves with it, has heard of the Holocaust and, God, gas chambers, these death factories, just beyond imagination. And you know, it's taught in schools across Canada and the United States and elsewhere. And so they have to confront it. But the fact is that most people are not experts in it. Not that the experts necessarily agree, but most people don't have a depth of knowledge to be able to adjudicate why this or that happened. Forget about explaining Hitler the person, but the Holocaust writ large, or why so many Germans would do what they did, or how, why the Holocaust entered the different, moved through different phases as it did. And so what you find is that, and I've encountered this repeatedly, that what most people say about the Holocaust is more a projection of their larger worldview or their understanding of good, evil, or of why human beings or social groups do what they do, or the role of ethics in society and whatever, and they impose their larger set of concerns, or they draw on their larger set of concerns to come up with their understanding of the Holocaust. And when I said the Holocaust is quite unusual, it's because virtually everybody has confronted this. In the way that people haven't thought about what really were the origins of the Second World War. I mean, most people aren't that concerned with that. Or why did the Civil Rights Movement happen when it did in the United States? Again, most people, that's not such a live question even in the United States. And so people project their own worldview for better or for worse, onto it, and it's very, very hard to change their views. I can't tell you how many people said, I read your book, Heroism and Executions. A lot of people read it, they really have. And you, it was great that you said X, and you know, that's not what I said. In fact, it's often the opposite of what I said in one way or another. And I know these people have read the book, and what they end up, and they end up incorporating it or homogenizing it with their prior beliefs. And this happens again and again and again with regard to the Holocaust. And so people don't like to confront evil or what's sometimes called radical evil head on and really grapple with it, as opposed to giving a religious explanation for it, which is a ready-made, pat explanation. Pat doesn't mean it's wrong, but you have a ready-made explanation. Or an explanation that derives from some notion of human nature, whatever that is, or an explanation that derives from the understanding of social psychology. And so they project these views, they become powerful, they stay with people, and it's very, very hard to get people to reform their views on this subject above all others. And I don't mean literally above all others, but I say that in a figurative and in a sense in which it's more true than not. Above all others, it's very, very hard to get people to change their views about the Holocaust. In the way that if I told you, look, most people think the origins of the Second World War are this, but I've done a lot of research, I've written books on it, it's really this. You say, oh, that's pretty interesting. I didn't know that. Oh, great, thank you. And you know, if you pay care at all, there's a greater chance that you will change your view on that than whatever I tell you or what someone else tells you about central questions for you about the Holocaust.
Maybe it's because, you know, there's this quote that's attributed to Elie Wiesel, right, where he says, when somebody says they want to kill you, believe them.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what has always struck me about this comment is that it speaks to a certain unwillingness that many people have, many Western leaders have, and continue to have, about sort of murderous intentions of others. You can go back to, you know, Neville Chamberlain at Munich. You can, even now, it's not clear that certain Western leaders take seriously that there are people in the world who are unafraid to kill and brutalize with impunity. And so you often have this kind of slow, hesitant Western response. In fact, in your book, Worse Than War, you've done extensive research on genocide. And I'm wondering, like, why do you think it is that when some party, a nation state or a terrorist organization or a non-state actor, they say they want to kill you, and they do, why it is that we don't seem to believe them?
I'm glad you mentioned Worse Than War. I was thinking, as you were beginning to ask the question, I wish I had the book with me because I would read a passage from it. In 1904, the Germans committed, it's not clear, in Southwest Africa, today Namibia, what was the first genocide of the 20th century, at least the first one that began in the 20th century, of the Herero people and other indigenous people to the region. And they were colonizing the area, and the Herero were resisting the colonization. Typical European, non-European imperial conflict. But the Germans responded with what the person in charge, who was the General von Trotta, called the extermination order. It was actually an order that was posted and read out to the German garrison about how they're going to exterminate the Herero and justify it. It was called the extermination order. And you read it, and it's just, again, to use that word, it's just unbelievable. You read it, and what it says about why the Herero have to be slaughtered and what the conditions are and so on and how they're just going to go do it. And they did it because they believed the Herero was subhuman, different from what they believed about Jews, but subhuman, not fit to live, were an impediment to the greater glory of the German Empire and well-being of the settlers and what have you. But they slaughtered the Herero in the most unbelievably gruesome ways, torturing them, flaying them alive. I won't be graphic about it. And we know that they thought it was right. We know that they wanted to do it. And when people read that order and they look at the Herero, that is experts, not most people don't know about the slaughter, they take it at face value that they, when they announced they were going to kill the Herero, they meant it. Hitler had made it pretty clear that his goal was the elimination of the Jews. He was circumspect about how it would be done until they started, and publicly he was remained relatively circumspect about it, though he did say on, I think, 11, I don't remember the number now, 11 occasions he announced on in public, including on national radio, that the war would end with the annihilation or the destruction of the Jews. He was explicit about it. But why don't people believe it? I think, Elliot, but you can tell me if I'm thinking correctly, that you're that this is implicitly about what political Islamists, the term I prefer to radical Islam and so on, that's another story, what political Islamists such as Hamas, Hezbollah, and many others say about Israel and Jews. And they are quite open. They are much more open in their stated murderousness or their desires for murder, mass murder of not just Israelis, but Jews, than the Nazis ever were. The Nazis didn't want to announce it publicly. They did it, but they didn't want to announce it for a variety of strategic reasons. And so why don't we take them seriously? Well, there's a lot of anti-Semitism in the West, a lot of sympathy for the impulses behind the desire to get rid of the Jews, even if most people in the West would not say that Jews should be slaughtered. I mean, they don't. Most people in the West would not subscribe or endorse that. The governments of the West and the rest of the world have to get along, even though you might not think that they, you might think the power relations are such that they don't have to get along in the sense, but they have to get along with Arab leaders, Arab countries, Islamic leaders, Islamic countries. And so they pretend it's not happening. And also, they believe, rightly or wrongly, that Israel's powerful enough and Jews are safe enough in the West and Israel's powerful enough to take care of itself, and the Jews will be, of course. I mean, no one's going to kill. It's not going to be a slaughter of Jews in Germany or in Britain or in the United States or here. So for a variety of reasons, it doesn't get them, they sympathize, different people sympathize with the impulse behind it. They want to get, they have to get along with the countries. I mean, these countries sit in international organizations. They have votes in the UN. They participate in all kinds of international organizations. NGOs are rampant with anti-Semitism because they have been captured by Arab and Islamic countries. One of the things that is striking, and we may be moving to contemporary anti-Semitism, about anti-Semitism today, is that there is an international political coalition of anti-Semites. And it consists of a large number of Islamic and Arab countries around the world with a tacit endorsement of any number of other developing countries and European countries. An international political alliance to spread anti-Semitism, to spread hatred, that is, and noxious notions about Jews and about Israelis in Israel. And there is no other people, historically or today, that you can say that there was an international political coalition to spread bigotry and hatred against them. And they have captured the international institutions of the world. It's one of the unusual and striking features of anti-Semitism today. It's international political content. So those are some things to say.
I mean, let's see if we can analogize or not analogize. You know, we talked before about data in Europe today, where it's clear that the thesis that it's just kind of a Muslim reaction is incorrect. One of the more fascinating studies I found was by the Technical University of Berlin. It came out last year. And what they did is they analyzed hate mail letters and emails and faxes that were sent over 10 years to the Israeli embassy in Berlin, 14,000 of them. And so what they found, this is Professor Monica Schwartz, found that 60% of the letters were written by educated, middle-class Germans, including professors, lawyers, priests, university and secondary school students. And that the people who wrote the letters were unafraid to give their names and addresses on the letters. And she said that's something that she felt very few Germans would have done 30 years prior. So perhaps it's inaccurate to see Muslim anti-Semitism as the main culprit for the changed climate. So what I'm wondering is this a repetition of the Holocaust? Let me clarify. It's obviously not the Europe of 1938. For one thing, like Angela Merkel, the leader, led a rally against anti-Semitism in Berlin, and she told Germans it's our national and civic duty to fight anti-Semitism. So it's not that we have sort of government-sponsored coercion of anti-Semitism like you had in the Nazi era. But what I'm wondering is if there's a repetition in the sense that the ordinary European today may be complicit with current anti-Semitism and not just a kind of Muslim fringe.
Let me just give you a few of the numbers to flesh out what Elliot said about the extent of anti-Semitism in Europe. The Pew study is actually not the best study to cite. Repeated surveys in European countries across Europe show that when you ask questions such as, do Jews have too much power in business? Do Jews have too much power in international financial markets? Do Jews have too much power? Do Jews care only about their own kind? That between 40% and 50% of people of Europeans say yes to those questions. The numbers vary somewhat from question to question, time to time. Two things are interesting about these questions. One, Elliot has already mentioned, which is that the Muslim populations of these countries are really not very large, a few percent, 6%, what have you. This is tapping into what non-Muslim French, Germans, Italians, Spaniards, Poles, Brits, what have you, believe. And the other thing is that all the questions, all the themes that I just mentioned have nothing to do with Israel. Jews have too much power in business, international financial markets, power, and so on. Absolutely nothing to do with Israel. These are age-old anti-Semitic canards. So we know that this is not being provoked by Israel, because if you ask questions about Israel, you get other kinds of answers, and they're certainly worth talking about too. And so this is a European phenomenon that is drawing on age-old anti-Semitic tropes. There are approximately, according to survey research, 100 million people in Europe who say that Jews today are guilty for the death of Jesus, even though the Catholic Church has absolved Jews today of this guilt charge. 100 million people in Europe say that is correct. The most damaging, prejudicial, in this case, anti-Semitic accusation of all time. They're complicit in, guilty for, the killing of the Son of God or God, depending on how you conceive of him. So the numbers make it clear that though there is a Muslim insurgency, anti-Semitic insurgency, in many, many European countries, that they have fertile soil in which to sow their particular brand of anti-Semitic hatred and accusations. So these questions have nothing to do with Israel, and let me just stop and focus on one of these questions, because one of the things we do is we move too quickly over these things. You hear something like, I don't know, maybe some of you don't, Jews have too much power in business. You say, oh, yeah, God. Okay, that sounds bad. Anti-Semitism. But let's stop and think about it. What does that possibly mean? What does it mean that people who are businessmen and businesswomen in Europe, when they happen to be Jews, are seen to be Jewish businessmen and businesswomen? Why aren't they just seen as businessmen and businesswomen doing what businessmen and businesswomen do, which is buy and sell, try to make profit, manufacture, do all the things that they do? Why is their Jewishness even relevant in the first place? It's a question we shouldn't just take for granted. It's something we shouldn't take for granted. That already shows how deeply anti-Semitic they are, that they see them as Jews. They don't say, I mean, to ask the question about Christian businessmen, businesswomen, it would be an absurd question. Kurdish businessmen, businesswomen, an absurd question. Okay. Then you think, what does it mean that they have too much power in business? Well, If you have too much power, if you're set to have too much power, it's because people obviously think you're going to do something bad with it. Well, what do they think? Otherwise, you wouldn't say they have too much. What do they think the Jews are doing with their alleged power and business that makes them say they're having too much of it? What are these Jewish businessmen and businesswomen hatching as plots against their fellow countrymen and countrywomen? Again, even the question contains so much anti-Semitism. And then when you know that the number of Jews in these countries and the number of Jewish businessmen and businesswomen is at the greatest number is less than 1% of Jews, it's often less than 0.1% and sometimes 0.001%. How can they possibly imagine that these tiny percentage of the population of the business people in their communities have too much power, that they somehow are threatening their countries? So the simple question, and then you might add, as if Swiss businessmen and businesswomen, business people are known for their ethics, Swiss banks, all that they've done, not to mention the business people in other countries and the financial shenanigans that go on. I mean, it's quite remarkable. Don't pass over these questions without interrogating them to see how deeply rooted this anti-Semitism is, that the question even makes sense in the first place to people. So it's deep-rooted, it's taken modern forms, it's transposed forms today. It's not focused only on Israel, even though it is hyper-focused on Israel. It's not just Muslims in Europe. It's age-old and new anti-Semitism. It's really back with enormous force. And Jews are becoming re-demonized in a way that I would not have imagined 15 years ago, or certainly 20 years ago. And no one did. And that's part of the reason that we're grappling with it.
I mean, would you say that there's the irrationality of it? Is it connected to the sort of moral underpinnings? You wrote that the people believed that what they were doing to the Jews was the right thing. In other words, so I'm wondering if the evil is so powerful precisely because it believes it's serving the highest good. Is that part of the fuel?
Well, you know, many people, when they do things which are morally questionable or which are morally at issue, doesn't have to be questionable, cloak what they do in a stated belief or subjective belief in the highest morality. But for some people are just afraid. They really believe these things, and they worry about the well-being of their country, their group. I mean, historically and today, it varies. When we talk about today, I mean, most Europeans aren't really that worried that Jews are going to seduce their daughters and poison their wells and do all kinds of horrible things to their neighbors. In fact, despite what I was saying, most of the anti-Semitism today in Europe is focused on in the international scene, not on the national scene. And open, explicit charges about one's countrymen and countrywomen who are Jews are still relatively taboo in most of Europe. The focus is on Israel, American Jews, what they're doing in the international arena. People don't like Jews, but the public, there's still mainly a taboo on saying, the Jews in our neighborhood are doing X, Y, and Z. People don't say that, at least in the West. But they do cloak what they say and genuinely believe that what they're doing is moral and in defense of the good and of themselves. And they believe it because they have an underpinning. The framework of understanding of anti-Semitism, whatever the specific understanding is, the following, and this is one of the things I argue in The Devil That Never Dies, that despite whatever the changes of anti-Semitism of the ages, and just think about it, Christian times started in the conflict over during Jesus' time over the custodianship of the Jewish tradition and whether Jesus was indeed the Messiah and the Son of God and so on. Through all the transformations that have taken place politically, economically, socially, culturally, through the centuries and centuries and into the modern times where it became secularized and racialized under the Nazis and before, And to this day, it's now globalized and it has different forms. It's taken so many forms and it's survived. It's quite an interesting, sociologically, it's quite interesting phenomenon and shows how tenacious it is and how deeply rooted it is in the West, and not just in the West, but also in Muslim lands. But whatever the specific form in charge is, form of anti-Semitism that exists, whether it's religious, racial, or today global, and whatever the charge is, there is a what can be called a foundational anti-Semitic paradigm that is constant, and it has the following elements. So whenever you hear anti-Semitic charges, except for things like maybe Jews are stingy, I mean, you know, these kind of low-level intergroup prejudices, think about this. Jews are fundamentally different from non-Jews. Jewish businessmen, Jewish businesswomen, why are they identified as Jews? Jews are fundamentally different from non-Jews. They are noxious or pernicious in some way. How that's specified varies a lot. They willfully do harm to non-Jews. They are powerful. The power can be a power of stealth or a power that Israel has as a military power, or as American Jews have with the supposedly manipulating the American Colossus. And therefore, they are dangerous. Very dangerous. And if you believe that, you draw the final conclusion from that, which is something has to be done to them. And not only should it be done, not only might it be done, not only should it be done, but it must be done. Because the well-being of non-Jews, of your community, of your family, of yourself, depends upon it. And the conclusion that has been drawn through the ages and is drawn today repeatedly and openly stated in the Muslim and Arab world and in protests in Europe is that Jews should be slaughtered. And you've all know about the Holocaust, but you may not know, all of you, of all the many mass slaughters that have taken place over the centuries, particularly in Europe, and all the eliminations and assaults against Jews. It is the commonplace of Jewish history for Jews to be subject to eliminationist assaults. And yes, they think they're moral in doing it. They think it's often, in today's Arab and Islamic world countries, it is consecrated with Allah's words that the Jews must be killed. And they're acting in the name of Allah. So yes, they think they're carrying out the highest moral good and indeed moral duty and also an act of self-preservation. They go hand in hand.
So it's curious, like this irrationality, right? Because look at the paradoxes that you're laying out. This tiny percent of people becomes a hyperbolic image of too much power. Or even, you know, we have a local example that everybody here in Toronto knows where, you know, you have a situation, just paradigmatically, I think it's a small thing, but you have a group called Queers Against Israeli Apartheid who protest each year against Israel. So there's something irrationally ironic here, right? You have a progressive state regarding gay rights. Certainly, they don't protest against any other Middle Eastern regime. And that's sort of baffling, right? Where you have, it's especially baffling because if you follow the sort of line of thinking of Queers Against Israeli Apartheid, it actually is self-liquidating, right? Because this is the one country that would protect them. So they're actually moving to kind of attack the one country that protect them in that region of the world and not attack the other countries which would actually eliminate them and quickly and brutally. So I think for many of us, that's sort of the baffling part. I mean, it's all baffling, but this is especially baffling where you're really taking a position against a state that is the only state that would, in theory, protect you.
In the region.
In the region, mm-hmm. Right? How's that explainable?
Well, let me broaden this out a little bit. One of the striking features about anti-Semitism, which differentiates it from other prejudices, all prejudices have distortions about the group being described or the group that is hated or the object of the prejudice, and that's why we call them prejudices. But anti-Semitism has taken such flights of fancy, has been so divorced from reality in the way that most prejudices are not. With Jews have been, in medieval times, almost axiomatically and universally identified with the devil as being devils themselves or being minions of the devil. This was genuinely believed by, virtually everyone in Europe in medieval and early modern times. During the Nazi period, they would look, I've already said it, upon Jews, a Jewish child, and see a Jew child, a genetically, in our terms today, we would say a genetically programmed being to try to subjugate humanity and to slaughter other human beings. This has nothing to do with reality. I'm not mentioning many of the other charges against Jews. Nothing to do with reality. And one of the striking features about anti-Semitism is how resistant people are to the facts, even when they're told them, even when they should know better. And this is, and the example that, which I don't happen to know this group, but there are many other such groups in the United States, the example that you mentioned is one of them, where you could say, but don't you know that Israel is the only country in the Middle East where people can be openly gay and not fear for their lives or what have you, and in fact where gay rights are protected and so on, and it has no effect. Israel is still described as a demonic country and somehow must be whatever they think. I don't know what this group, if they have a corporate position about it. Now, I mentioned European stuff on European views of Israel. 50% of the people in the European Union, half the people, so we're talking over 250 million people, if you include kids, 50% of them say Israel is conducting a war of extermination against the Palestinian people. A war of extermination. Now, you can have whatever your view is on the Middle East conflict, on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, right, wrong. There are lots of, there's a whole range of views people can have that are within the realm of reason, or even within the realm of being sort of unreasonable, but within the realm of not of lunacy. But saying that Israel is conducting a war of extermination against the Palestinian people is literally lunatic. One of the things I don't think we should do when dealing with anti-Semites is say, but here are the facts, and start having an argument about the facts, but I'll just give you a couple of facts so you, in case you don't know them. In the 20-year period leading to, before the Israel divested itself of Gaza, before they gave Gaza up to the Palestinians, the Palestinian population under Israeli control doubled. Doubled in a 20-year period. How's that a war of extermination? For the 10-year period prior to that handover of Gaza, the birth rate in the Palestinian territories was the highest in the world. How's that a war of extermination? These facts, not literally these facts, but it's so obvious to anybody who's paying the least bit of attention that Israel is not conducting a war of extermination. That means a genocide, and guess what? Europeans know what that means. Close to 50% of the public in Germany says Israelis are conducting a genocide against the Palestinians. It has nothing to do with reality. And this is one of the hallmarks of prejudice, of bigotry, that people are not able or willing to incorporate powerfully disconfirming information into their views of the world and to revise their views. And that's the answer to your question. It's a simple answer, which is that the people in this group, at least when they're, who knows what they really believe, but when they're in public marching in solidarity with the other groups, including a lot of feminists, if you want to be a woman in the Middle East with rights that approximate anything that you have in Canada or we have in the United States, there's one country you want to be in and a lot of countries you don't want to be in. And everybody knows it. There's a whole litany of such things. They're so deeply prejudiced, they're so caught in a prejudicial, in an alliance that is founded on anti-Semitic bigotry, that everything else becomes secondary or is denied. You know, it's a higher solidarity with oppressed Palestinian people of the world is a higher goal than pursuing women's rights or gay rights or how about just the rights of people not to be subjected to dictatorships of one kind or another, or to be threatened or to have their security under threat because they are of a different Islamic or non-Islamic sect or non-Islamic religion. How about the rights of all those people? You know, there was a very, very good article in the Wall Street Journal. By the way, my politics, at least with regards to domestic American politics, are that of the center-left. I'm hardly a typical Wall Street Journal reader, though you should read both sides of everything. within the spectrum of reason. Two or three days ago, there was an excellent article by an Egyptian, whose name I don't remember, about what he faces when he tries to get, he lives in New York, people in the West, to face the realities of what political Islam is like and what life is like for women, gays, for lots of people in Islamic countries. And it's about how appalling it is, how appalling the reactions of people in academia and the media and others are to just confronting the basic facts and how they don't want to deal with it and how they attack him for being anti-Islamic, for saying these things. So dig up the article if you're interested. It's really a very pithy presentation of a whole set of important issues.
I'm really bummed.
Because there's a certain, there's a flexibility that you're describing that makes it almost a kind of incurable notion, right?
Do you want me to make it really bad now?
You know, we haven't reached bottom yet, have we?
No, the thing's much worse than that.
Okay, now go for it.
Okay. Look, anti-Semitism has become globalized. It's a different kind of anti-Semitism from before. And there are a lot of features of global anti-Semitism which are different from modern, so-called modern racial anti-Semitism and Christian anti-Semitism. But one of them is that it's everywhere in the world now. The ADL just had a study, but with a very strict or very high threshold for declaring somebody anti-Semite. They had to subscribe to six, on a battery of 11 anti-Semitic questions, they had to subscribe to six of them. In my view, if you hold one anti-Semitic position, you're an anti-Semite. I mean, just as you would say, if someone says blacks are lazy, you'd say he's a racist. You don't have to know whether he thinks blacks are subhuman or anything else. Just say he's a racist. So if someone says Jews have too much of our own business, he's an anti-Semite. He doesn't have to score on five other anti-Semitic things. Anyway, they had a high standard. And they surveyed 100 countries in the world, and 26% of the people met their very strict criteria for anti-Semitism. That's 1.1 billion people in the countries they surveyed around the world. It's global. It's everywhere. It's in countries where there are no Jews. Another strange feature of anti-Semitism. You think there's anti-Kurdish bigotry in countries where there are no Kurds? I mean, it's in Iraq, it's in Turkey, and so on. I mean, there's no other people against whom there's a worldwide bigotry when they're not all over the world. You know, Americans, the U.S. is sort of all over the world, so there's anti-Americanism everywhere. But there is this against Jews. It's everywhere, in all countries, huge numbers of people, and it's all over the internet and all over digital media. It's part of the substructure of prejudice. When you know that, by some measures, 40-50% of the people in China, Brazil, Japan are anti-Semitic, what do you do? It's part of the substructure. It's floating on the internet. Type Jew into Bing or to Google, and one of the top sites that comes up is called Jew Watch. Jew Watch News. You should go to that site. An innocent kid or an adult saying, what is this thing about Jews? Types in Jews. Normal thing to do, Wikipedia. Jew Watch. What is that? It's an emporium of Jew hatred that claimed to have 1.5 billion pages of anti-Semitic stuff, organized according to major themes, Jewish conspirators, Jewish mass murders, just one thing after the next. How do you fight it? It's everywhere. It's available with a few clicks. Where do you go? It used to be you knew where to go. You went to the Vatican. You said, look, please stop it. You had an address. There's no address anymore. It's in the public spheres of dozens of countries around the world where anti-Semitism is as central to the public and cultural lives of those countries as Islam is. What do you do? It's all over Europe. What do you do? You don't even know how to find... I actually have a question for you. And one of the things that I know a lot about contemporary anti-Semitism.
Really? You get a question? Do I get a fee or what is it?
I know a lot about contemporary anti-Semitism, and I often say, the one exception, you know, Israel is Israel. The one exception to all this is the United States, where there's anti-Semitism, but anti-Semitism is not in the public sphere. American Jews don't worry about speaking their views, except for on college campuses is another thing. They're more worried about speaking their views because they're not worried it'll make them suspect about Israel if they speak their views, whatever they are. the public sphere. American Jews have been integrated into the national community. They are Americans in the view of almost all Americans. And so anti-Semitism, and Jews pursue their interests as they understand them with a vigor and openness that you don't find anywhere else. And the country I don't know how really to think about is Canada. Because there are reasons, from what I see, to say that Canada is kind of an in-between case and is a little more like Europe than the United States is like Europe, and a little more like the United States than Europe is like the United States. But it doesn't seem to me it's like the United States, and it doesn't seem to me it's like Europe. Where does Canada stand on this?
I mean, I'm not the best person to ask.
Well, maybe someone here knows more. But
it's not one country. So in other words, you have pockets of the country that obviously have more historical origins of anti-Semitism. If you go to Quebec and certain areas of Quebec, certainly historically, even right up to the separatism vote where Mr. Parizeau came out and blamed the ethnic vote for the loss of sovereignty, and he was obviously referring to the Jews. So there are, obviously those who grew up in Quebec know that historically there was anti-Semitism there. Of course, I was in Israel when Mr. Harper came on his visit, and the editorials in Israel, well, this guy's like more pro-Israeli than most people in the Knesset, which he is. In other words, there's paradoxes in the country about,
Yeah, but the question I'm asking is, how do Jews feel in this country about their security, their physical security, about displaying signs of Jewishness, kippot, Stars of David, the incidences of anti-Semitic attacks in this country are quite substantial. And certainly far higher as a proportion of the population than the people who are supposedly subjected to the most bigotry in Canada and the United States, which are Muslims. The rate of attacks upon Jews in this country is something like 12 times higher than it is against, adjusted for population, than it is against Muslims. So how secure do Canadian Jews feel and about being openly Jewish, about pursuing their interests openly as communities, about speaking their minds, about their standing in Canada?
My impression is they feel very secure. I think they feel very comfortable expressing their Jewishness. I don't think people feel fear or hesitation there are security at events, but I get the sense that people are very, very comfortable with their Jewishness here, but probably somebody else can answer that better than me. There's a couple other things I wanted to ask, and I also want to point out there's a mic on the floor here, and I'm going to invite people to step up to the mic in a minute or so if you want to ask questions from the floor. So if you do have a question, I would advise you to begin to line up there. You ruled out rational discourse, right? You were speaking rhetorically here about the fact, like, what is someone to do when you have all of these attitudes? And you ruled out rational discourse. In other words, you can't talk to people because the facts won't speak. That leaves us in a pretty desperate position. In other words, what you seem to be implying is there's nothing to be done. It just has to be endured. I'm assuming that's not what you mean.
Because I'm shaking my head now.
So what is it that you would say?
We have to have realistic goals. And, of course, there's some people you can have rational discourse with. I mean, the people who are marching in these marches are, by and large, you can. But there are a lot of people who don't have very firm views about Jews or Israel. Israel or anti-Israelism being the expressive focus of anti-Semites, because that's a legitimate way to express it almost anywhere. And so those people are persuadable. Many people are open to discussion, open to learning, and so we do need to talk to them. And
when you say that, would you say that actually the more important conversation is not with people who are sort of screaming at you and yelling the banners, but actually with the person in the middle, who's kind of just an ordinary citizen, may go this way, may go that way, and that's where the focus should be.
Yes, that is what I'm saying. Let's move beyond the different types of people or people of different persuasions and think in a larger way. People often say, you know, the what's trotted out is the thing everybody's in favor of and the thing everybody should do is education, right? It solves all problems. We know education is, takes a long time to solve a lot of problems, and it's very hard to bring about in a lot of circumstances. And so if you look around the world, it's very hard to educate people not to be prejudiced. We know this. It takes a long time and a lot of work, whether the prejudice against Jews or people of darker skin or lighter skin or women, men, what have you. But our capacity to educate people depends upon our ability to have discussions with them, and to, as teachers, as friends, as co-workers, as maybe children to their parents. We have zero capacity to educate people in Egypt or in Iran or in Palestinian territories or, for that matter, most of Europe about the real state of Jews or in China or whatever. We have zero capacity. We can't. We have no access to them. We're foreigners. There's nothing to do. So you can work in your local communities, and you can work in your national communities in Canada, the United States, in many European countries. And I'm all for that. But the critical thing is something else, and this is what we really can do. We can use the United States as a model, and perhaps Canada as well, where anti-Semitic discourse, open anti-Semitic discourse in the public sphere in the United States is a taboo. There are some exceptions, and it's breaking down to some extent. It's a taboo. If a politician comes out and makes an anti-Semitic remark, a really anti-Semitic remark, he is considered unfit for public life. If a public figure does that as well, not a politician, unfit for public life, just as if you utter racist things against African Americans. This is a great historic achievement. And we had this in Europe for 40 years after the Holocaust, but the taboo has been broken. And it's critical, and this is what we can do, that it be reestablished. That it be reestablished to the extent it's been eroded here in Canada, or maybe not established. You talk about the Quebec politician. In Europe, it can be reestablished. The elites in Europe are coming to understand how dangerous anti-Semitism, and that's why Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, went and spoke at an anti-Semitic rally against anti-Semitism. They understand how dangerous it is. This has to be reasserted, and if you do that, you've achieved a lot. You haven't achieved everything. People are still going to be prejudiced. But when it's out of the public sphere, it is not then the basis for political mobilization. It doesn't confirm and spread hatreds further. People don't see that powerful and influential people share their views. Young people aren't more easy to don't find it more easily to be converted to anti-Semitism. This is an achievable goal. It doesn't mean it'll be easy. This is what we should work for. And if we can do that, as we've done in the United States, it would go very, very far along the way to tamping down anti-Semitism. One other thing, and this I think is true of Canada. Again, I'm not an expert on Canada. It is true of the United States. I've mentioned it before. Jews in Europe are not considered members of the national community. They are German Jews, French Jews, whatever. Even if they're recognized as citizens, they're not considered really to be fully Germans, French, Brits, what have you. In the United States, they are Americans. In Canada, they are Canadians. This is something else that we have to educate the Europeans about, to understand that it's a strange term, Jewish Germans, Jewish French, Jewish English doesn't really work linguistically, Jewish Italians, and not Italian Jews, not Canadian Jews, not American Jews, they're Jewish Americans. This is very important. We're members of our national communities, no different from others. We just happen to have a different particularistic identity, as many people do within these pluralistic societies.
Okay. I'm really done up here, so just wanted to make a couple of announcements before we take questions. First of all, please give a warm hand to Dr. Goldhagen. We're going to be having what I consider another really good conversation here on Saturday night, this Saturday, November 1st, where I will be in conversation with the British journalist Melanie Phillips, and you're all invited to attend that. So I just wanted to say that. And if you want to look at other programs that we're running at Torn Motion, please check our website at tornmotion.org. I also wanted to thank you all on behalf of my family for coming out and honoring the memory of my father. And with that, I will turn the floor over to the questioners. Please make it a question and make it succinct.
Good evening. Thank you for a thought-provoking piece. I was going to ask a question anyway, but I wanted to relate it to something that you were talking about how Canadians feel. We spend half our time in the UK and half our time here. And it's often the case that around the Shabbat dinner table, on a Friday night or a Shabbos lunch, the conversation can turn to the question, is it time to leave the UK and go to Israel? I have not heard that here. And if that tells you how Canadian Jews feel, that may well be an indicator for you. But is it time to leave the UK? Is it time to leave Europe?
First, let me say that we should also thank Elliot for hosting the evening. In addition to the spur to conversation that he is here, I had a wonderful dinner with him in which we talked about a wide range of issues that were much more uplifting by and large than these. And so he's quite capable of that. I hope you can see this side of him too sometime. So thank you, Elliot.
You're welcome.
I don't think there's much future for the Jews of Europe. And I'm not the only one. Many European Jewish leaders say as much as well. Things are going downhill there. Jewish communities, someone mentioned there are guards here, but Jewish communal institutions and events, synagogues, community centers are like fortresses in Europe and in danger of attack, subject to attack. Jews live in fear, and it's not just this gentleman's Shabbat conversation partners that who muse or wonder whether it's time to leave the UK, but this is happening all over France, all over Europe in general, and many are leaving. Many are leaving, and many say they intend to leave. And things are only going to get worse before they get better, unless we have this taboo reinserted in the public sphere, re-established for the public sphere. The open hostility, the violence, which is written off to Muslims exclusively, and it's not only Muslims, particularly in Germany, it's not. But the Muslim community is growing bolder. That is, and again, we're not talking about all Muslims, of course. We have to say, of course, we're not talking about all Muslims. But those who are violently anti-Semitic are becoming more numerous and more open and more overtly targeting Jews and not just Israel or its representatives and so on. So I would expect that the numbers will continue to dwindle and... you know, it's a sad event. It may be that in 20 or 30 years that it'll be Israel, the United States, and Canada, and maybe Australia, and that'll be about it for Jews.
Hi there. I'd just like to make a quick Canadian comment. I think that when the Conservative government and Harper lose power, I think that our situation is, as Jews in Canada, will become much less than it is now in terms of comfort. Putting that aside, you've somewhat answered my question. I was going to say that I tell most people that there are four countries in Europe that I'm never going to go to, one in Western Europe and three in Eastern Europe. The one in Western Europe, which people never guess, is Austria. And the three in Eastern Europe are Lithuania, the Ukraine, and now I include Hungary. Poland I've been to just because I went on the March of the Living, so that gets excluded. But my question was going to be, should I extend that? And you've somewhat answered that. So I go to my second question, which really flips us back to North America. And because you were affiliated with the same institution that I used to be affiliated by my hat, what really drives me crazy, and I was at Harvard in the early 70s, and there was just the basic anti-Semitism of blue bloods disliking Jews. But now, with the permeating divestiture, BDS, and thereby extending to just general anti-Semitism, I'm just wondering, are there enough Dershowitzes to combat the anti-Semitism on premier American university campuses, or are we going to lose that battle too?
One question for clarification. When you say you won't go to these countries, is it because you're concerned or because it is a boycott of sorts?
I'm sorry, what was the last part?
Because you're boycotting these countries.
Yeah, I'm boycotting. I'm not concerned for myself.
Right, okay. Were we on the same plane together?
No.
Did you
I
fly
was another
today?
Harvard guy, no.
Oh, because you look like... Anyway, that's okay. I flew in today. You know, survivors of the Holocaust have often asked me, should I go back to Germany? That is, those who are from Germany go back. And I say, look, it's for you to decide. It's not for me to tell you what to do. I mean, I would never tell a survivor of the Holocaust to do anything that he or she doesn't want to do with regard to that is relevant to how he or she deals with, confronts, or lives with the horrors that he or she has suffered, and so on. But I do say that Germany's a different country. It's not the same country it was. And Ukraine, for all its problems, is not the same country it was. And it's still quite, there's still a lot of anti-Semitism in both countries, and in some ways the Ukraine or Lithuania are less reconstructed than Germany is, and Hungary certainly. It's just a question back to you. What's your threshold for not wanting to go to these countries? There are plenty of countries. If what you're saying is, if a country has an anti-Semitic, a sufficient percentage of the population, or a non-trivial percentage of the population which is anti-Semitic, and has a public sphere which is polluted by anti-Semitism, and where Jews really could not feel comfortable living there, should I not go there, then you can take almost every country of Europe off. If that's your standard. But the question ultimately becomes, what is your standard? What's the threshold that a country has to meet to lose your tourist dollars or business dollars or whatever? Then with regard to American college campuses, it's very disturbing. It's the one thing that really goes against what I've been saying about the United States. Not the one thing, but the major thing. And it is uncomfortable for Jews on American college campuses to express their Jewishness openly, certainly in any relationship to Israel.
And is that true for the Ivy League schools too?
Yes. I've stopped teaching about 10 years ago, so I'm a little bit I'm not in the thick of it anymore. And the faculties of University of the United States are overwhelmingly anti-Israel. Many of them are anti-Semitic, that's quite clear. And the anti-Israel alliance is quite vigorous, is indeed a dominant part of the college campuses today. There are very few people who speak out, and very few people who will speak out the way Dershowitz, who himself has stopped teaching. I know he's not teaching full time. He retired. He may be doing some teaching. And university presidents aren't standing up for free speech, you know, on both sides, as it's called. And so it's quite worrisome. The U.S. is interesting, where 75% of Americans strongly side with Israel over the Palestinians in the conflict. Who are you sympathetic to? Who do you favor? And so on. And in the public sphere, the American political leadership and the elites are overwhelmingly supportive of Israel. And so that's a powerful homogenizing, a powerful re-educative effect on students once they get. I mean, you know, just how many students talk about pursuing noble causes as understood by what university students understand it to be, and then they end up working for Goldman Sachs or for IBM or for law firms, whatever, where they end up doing what most people do, which is pursuing their professions and not doing something quote-unquote noble. And so, you know, we'll have to see what the long-term effects of it are, but it's quite unpleasant now, and it's a tough nut to crack.
Thank you.
So, Do you think that the human rights movement is being co-opted, is co-opting the Holocaust and the memory of the Holocaust, and is, you know, anti-Semitism in another guise? I think you were saying something different from that when you were saying public speakers, people in the public realm, ought to be prevented from saying anything anti-Semitic. But I find that at a lot of public rallies, there's a tremendous alignment between spokesmen for human rights and anti-Israelism in all its forms.
The international human rights movement, and more generally NGOs of all different kinds, already have been co-opted by anti-Semites. It's not a process that is underway. It's already happened.
But they claim that it's from the Holocaust and that they're carrying the lessons from the Holocaust forward,
well,
and that's how they arrive at that position.
Right. One of the techniques of anti-Semites is what's sometimes referred to as Holocaust inversion, which is to say that the Israelis or Jews are doing what was done to them. It may be said with a degree of sympathy, you know, they suffered so much, now they're doing the same thing. It's terrible, isn't it? But nevertheless, Israel, as you well know, is treated as the Nazi Germany today, and Jews and Israelis as the Nazis today. And this is a common trope among all manner of anti-Semites or people who are supposedly anti-Israel. I say supposedly because they are anti-Israel, but they're really anti-Semites who are expressing it in this way. And all you need to know is what happened at Durban, which is now more than a decade ago, when the NGO conclave, there was a UN conference, there was a separate NGO conclave, where most of it was devoted to anti-Semitism or anti-Israelism, where they put out these position papers and had rallies that made them look like they should fit in with the Nazi, you know, with their Nazi forebears, as not that they see them as forebears, but they were. And Human Rights Watch, you know, one has to have an ambivalent attitude towards some of these groups. I mean, they do a lot of good, but they're so profoundly anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. Yeah. Human Rights Watch, the UN Council on Human Rights, other human rights groups, they relentlessly put out reports that are, whether they're containing true and many non-true charges against Israel, to an obsessive degree, when they're ignoring at the same time many, by any measure, whatever your standards are, many worse transgressions by other countries and groups, and they don't pay attention to them. These forums have become anti-Semitic incubators and spreaders. The UN today is the single most, and I say this with a heavy heart, the single most powerful source, international source, and spreader of anti-Semitism in the world.
And that's our problem.
So we're gonna wrap up the public discussion here. I invite everybody up who wants to ask a private question to do so, but that is going to end our public discourse. I want to thank you all for coming very much.